started going to church when I was about 14 years old. And I spent a couple of years as a fanatical Mormon and became an agnostic.
So your religious beliefs did start with Mormonism.
Yeah, and I was about the seventh grade, and I started with Methodism, actually. Closest church around was Methodist. I would go to Methodist, and I'd round up all the kids in the block, and we would go to Methodist Sunday school. And I was really into this religion. My parents would take me to church and leave me off, and he'd come to church afterwards and pick me up. But neither one of them wanted anything to do with Mormonism themselves.
So were they atheists?
No, my grandfather had a kind of a religion of his own in which he believed in God, and that if you were good, you'd be treated right the next life time and all this. But a very simple thing, and I think that was basically, that was basically my mother's religion. And it really didn't have a name. Eisenhower Republican.
Okay, that's the first thing that you were.
Politically, yeah.
All right, an Eisenhower Republican.
Yeah, I agreed with every editorial in the Los Angeles Mirror, Virgil Finkley wrote, more authoritarian, middle of the road and conservative. And it was in the military that my views changed. Just before I went into the military, I discovered the First Unitarian Church in Los Angeles. And that was very left-wing in its orientation.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really liked their attitude. You know, there was a pamphlet there called Unitarianism, a Three-Time Loser,
mm-hmm.
describing how the church had failed to evolve on three different occasions towards greater tolerance and away from racism and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I just liked that candor. But I don't know, Greg sent me a card, postcard a few years back, and it said on it the question, what do you get when you cross a Unitarian with a Jehovah's Witness? And the answer, someone who wanders door to door for no apparent reason. You know. You kind of always wind up with the Unitarians kind of feeling like, well, why is this a church? You know, it's a church for people who don't believe in God or something, mm-hmm. basically.
Mm-hmm.
But at one time, it was a big thing because the Unitarians believed there was only one God and not a Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was all over, and why they were called Unitarians. They were very persecuted for believing that God was not a God. I went into the Marine Corps with a bit of an interest in socialism and communism. I remember my first unit, when I went on active duty, I was sitting there one day reading a biography of Lenin, and his sergeant walked by. Staff sergeant, Christian Scientist staff sergeant. And he says, you know, Thornley, I look at the books you read sometimes and I wonder about you. And I say, well, I know thine enemy. And he said, yeah, well, I still wonder about you. And he walked out of the hut. And I didn't know there was another staff sergeant sitting right behind me. Said to the guy next to me, I've never met a group of people more proud of their own ignorance than staff sergeants in the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a guy who's willing to give his life fighting communism, and he was willing to die, keep that from becoming everybody's way of life. Well, I got a very disturbing statistic somewhere that said 60% of the people in the world went to bed hungry every night. I went to Manila when I was in the Philippines on leave on a weekend, and one of the first things I saw when the cab driver left me off in the, right next to the big poor section of the town, city of walls, bombed out buildings that were bombed in the war, where people lived in cardboard huts and so forth. And here's this man walking down the street in my direction who looks like a skeleton. I mean, he just absolutely doesn't look like he's going to last another day or two. And as he passes me, I notice he has this real look of panic in his eyes. I always sort of imagine that as people starve to death, their minds dulled and he's faded away. But here he was very alert and very afraid and very desperate looking. And the U.S. had owned the Philippines until July 4th, 1948, I believe it was. And this was going on, and I just decided that my communist friend and Nick Granich and San Francisco was right to fill their stomachs and then worry about the civil liberties. Everybody that was responsible for creating the situation to be lined up and shot. I used to get very angry. And so I started reading books on communism. So I found this big, thick philosophical volume written by a Jesuit about dialectical materialism. And so I read that. Same time I was reading the Bhagavad Gita, and it kind of seemed to me to be saying the same thing, which is, work hard and devote yourself to your duties and don't lust after results. Everybody will be happy and everything will be fine. And then not long before I left, I was introduced to somebody else because they were an atheist, as was I. Same thing happened to us. Well, this guy's name was Mims. I was one of those atheists that you're probably...
Did you become a communist?
Well, I decided that when I came back to the United States, the first thing I was going to do was contact Nick Granich and ask him how I could be most useful to the cause as a member of the Communist Party or as a fellow traveler. Somebody said, "Hey, Kerry, there's another atheist in the outfit. Do you want to meet him?" I said, "Yeah." And they just merged our outfit with a couple of others and a lot of new people. And somebody took me over to his hut. His name was Mims, M-I-M-S, and he said, like Oswald has said, communism is my religion. Mims said, "This book here is my Bible," and it was Atlas Shrugged, and he turned to Galt's Oath, "I will spend no part of my life for another man, or ask any other man to spend any part of his life for me." When I first heard of that, I thought, my God, it's epitome of amorality, and I was having a really hard time figuring out what kind of link between logic and ethics. I mean, there really was no logical reason to be good, and yet I wanted to be good, and I wanted to punish people who were bad. I couldn't really justify it in terms of the whole worldview, and so I read Whitman when I was about 14, too. He had a big influence on me. And through all these changes, I decided to read Atlas Shrugged and picked up a copy in the Yokohama and started reading it on board ship. A few days before I left, and I found it very convincing. Bud Simcoe came by, and he had been offending me from the officers and said I was a communist by saying, "He's more American than I am. He's more American than you are."
Before you really became a communist, you moved right through that into the Ayn Rand thought.
Yeah, well, this thing like big change to me. I was just moving from scientific socialism to scientific capitalism. The important thing to me was that Ayn Rand was an atheist. But the idea that there could be a morality based on rationality really appealed to me. She said it's like building a bridge. There's a right way and a wrong way to build a bridge. And the same with society. There's a right way and a wrong way to destruct a society. And that gave me some basis to think of right and wrong. It also dispensed entirely with altruist morality, which was, the being unselfish thing. And I still feel content in my heart for altruists a lot of times. So I went back to my base to get my belongings a couple of days before we set sail, and from the processing barracks I was in Yokosuka. And Bud walked up to me and he said, "Well, have you decided what you're going to do when you get back to the States?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to be a capitalist pig."
All right.
And what I decided I would do is that my big argument that persuaded me was, in order for there to be enough production for you to feed everybody, the producers had to be rewarded. And so what if they got more than the other people, because everybody was better off because they were in the world. And so he was surprised, and I showed him the book. Then I was reading it on the way back to the States. My only remaining doubt as I was reading it was that maybe she wasn't an atheist, because there's one scene there when Francisco de Anconia destroys this Mexican village where Anaconda Copper was, had a mine that was nationalized. But he says, "But they left the church because they'll need it." And so,
because they'll need it.
Yeah. But then at some point, came out very strong atheist. So by the time I got back to the States, I was had a whole new plan. I was going to go back to the Philippines, which I really liked. And I was going to open up, when I read a communist, I was going to published a newspaper in the Philippines called the Red Rooster, and I was going to open up a coffee tobacco shop in Manila, a little atmospheric type place, and kind of a quaint old store. I don't know, it was like, and I was going to raise chickens. I was going to own and invest in chicken farms because the cheapest source of protein in the world is chicken. I was going to feed everybody in the Philippines. Yeah, probably. Ogden Nash wrote the shortest poem in the English language. It was titled Fleas, and the poem itself was Adam Haddam. And so I composed the shortest prayer, which is Jesus, please us.
What do you think?
I try not to think. It always gets me in trouble. In 1965, after the trauma of dealing with the people who loved Kennedy so much, and they wanted to kill me for hating him and saying that I'm glad he was shot, and the knowing Oswald and the Marines and all that. I left New Orleans and was living alone in Virginia, and I just decided to write Greg, and we started corresponding, and with the Scorpion, and I suddenly discovered a use for nonsense. I realized it was really therapeutic. If there were discordian torchlight parades, you know, it's just, you can be, have just as much fun as fascists have in the name of nonsense instead of something destructive. And so, I saw a Steve Allen thing one night where he was reading this poem about people named Clyde, written by this guy named Clyde, defending people named Clyde, and his, as the reading went on, one of these very rhythmic poems, and the governor started drumming in the band, and people started marching around the stage, and they started turning the lights on and off and everything, and it really looked like the kind of, you said, celebrating nothing but confusion.
What is the relationship between discordianism or chaos and anarchy, or what is the difference?
Well, anarchy is a, contrary to popular belief, is a more sophisticated, higher level of social organization than we've got now. It's not society that's so organized that it doesn't have to coerce anybody. Discordianism is a kind of callous and chaosophers, chaosd.
Callous.
They're the ones who go around,
sacred cow.
Go around stirring up chaos, and this is the one that.
As a provocateur.
Just the other, and this, well, whatever, and the ones that observe chaos and appreciate it. And then there's the knowers, you know. And, in my book, they're the ones who know better than we want. See, Wilson and Craig and I had a big argument about this. Somebody had already killed somebody in the name of discordianism in Los Angeles. And somebody else had written a letter to the Free Press about it. I don't know what happened or not, but they wrote the letter. Greg read it and got all freaked out. For me, it was, well, what do you expect? You know, I mean, this is a society of people joined by nailing their applications of membership on telephone poles and hearing all kinds of people.
I was wondering about people who. Who take discordianism as an endorsement for committing crimes against people? I don't think
it's
that was
not an endorsement for anything. It's it's just it's reality with a name imposed on it of an organization. You know, it's just what was there already in unorganized form is still there in unorganized form, but now it has a name, you know, and that's the Scoria Society. Mm-hmm. They're the most Scorias that ever met one another, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Wilson's feeling about it all was that he shouldn't worry about what happens in the name of the Scoriaism. It would be appropriate for everything to happen in the name of the Scoriaism.
Oh, everything must happen before it can all be over.
In 1963, Greg Hill introduced me to marijuana, and we got stoned together. And it just seemed to me, at the beginning it seemed to me as if something kind of constipated and self-important about Ayn Rand. I found somebody suggested that I read Psychotherapy East and West by Alan Watt. And so I read that. I was enormously impressed. And his basic point was that what's wrong with the world is that everybody's so concerned about surviving. If we just live like the Zen masters, as if life were a dream, we'd all be much happier. It's just the opposite of what I read. You equated egoism with survival. You know? Your survival was the top value for her, Alan Watts, at the bottom of the list. I read that, and I also began smoking more marijuana. Then I went out to the West Coast after the Kennedy assassination.
So, was Eris interfering with you before you were interfering with Eris?
No, not in the least.
Okay. So as soon as you became aware of Eris Discordia, did you become a Discordian right then and there?
I was the co-founder of the Discordian Society, the Discordianism was something that started in high school, though. We're talking now about years later, and I didn't regard it as serious thought at the time. Greg has added some very philosophical stuff that makes it more profound than it would be otherwise. After I got out of the service and had become this raving right winger, Greg and I became fast friends and organized the Discordian Society, disorganized the Discordian Society at that point. There was no place to be in Whittier very much if you're under 18. And we were hanging out in bowling alleys for that reason. There were these 24-hour bowling alleys. And one night we were walking down Whittier Boulevard, and overnight, police stopped us and they told us that you're guilty of vagrancy. And Greg said, "Vagrancy? I live here." And he says, "Yeah, but that doesn't make any difference. You're out at odd and unusual hours." Cops pulled away. I turned to Greg. I said, "Greg, let's go somewhere else. Either San Francisco or New Orleans." And I said, "Let's go to New Orleans. It's farther away from Whittier." I'd been very admiring of the Hindu religion some years back, and had thought once in a while, it's too bad I couldn't believe in that. All this other stuff too. And suddenly what the LSD said to me is that the Hindus were right. So that's what happened to me. I was now sort of a psychedelic Hindu, and at the same time I was growing farther culturally. I just began growing far away from Ayn Rand. I went out to California, and while I was in political agreement with the people that ran Innovator, most of them were really all reason and no rhyme. They just completely utilitarian. The office was very kind of ugly looking. I began to drift away from them because of that. I wound up in about 1966, I guess it was. Robert Hanson Wilson was my brother. Maybe 67 or 68. Anyway, I sent him a copy of the Innovator and he wrote me a letter. And we got into an argument about the views of the anarchist Lysander Spooner, who was a monetary mutualist, which is the same very much in banking as it is now, and against charging interest. There was an article by Lysander Spooner.
Robert Anton Wilson. Was that your first contact with him?
No, he wrote me a letter. I sent him an interview. If you're interested in Pointer's, Pointer organized his own post office, on a bet. He's an attorney. I asked him also to the government who would deliver the mail. So he organized the American Letter Mail Company, making more deliveries a day than the government was charging less for stamps and making a profit besides. And eventually they had to make it against the law.
What are you today? What is your belief system today, leaving behind the things that you once believed?
Well, pretty much essentially what it was after Wilson and I got in this argument about Spooner. He sent me a bunch of pamphlets about Spooner's economic ideas. And I wrote back and I said, you know, my problem with left-wing anarchists is that they seem tough, like they're more interested in killing all the bankers and insurance men and this, that, and the other thing than they are about overthrowing the government. And he wrote back and he says, well, actually, that's not true. He says, most left-wing anarchists are interested in things like child-rearing. I had over the summer, by A.S. Neal. That really caught my imagination. And so I became a left-wing
anarchist. I'm doing your intellectual history here, but I would like to go to the present.
Philosophy I held at that point, after the arguments with Wilson, is the philosophy I hold at present.
And how would you characterize it in terms of what you are now?
Well, it's got a lot of names, none of which are very appropriate. One of them is they call it decentralism. And another, they call it individualist anarchism. So the grandmother of the counterculture was very much involved with it all her life, Mildred Loomis.
Mildred Loomis?
Yeah. When I met her, she was an old lady, and she really was interested in all these young ideas. I remember sexual communes and things of that sort. And there was a book called The Inherit Experiment. She wanted to get a copy of it. She was in Tampa for a little while, the rest station, the Lyleton. So we went over to the nearest bookstore, and right there in downtown Tampa, and she says to the girl, the little old lady, you know, says to the girl behind the counter, do you have a book called The Herod Experiment? And the girl says, I'm not sure. She says, what kind of book is it? She says, it's a sex book. So the girl says, well, I'm afraid we don't carry that kind of book here. So
yeah.
Mildred went back and found a copy on the shelf and picked that up very triumphantly, purchased it.
It's a novel. But at this point, you know, I'm just trying to kind of encapsulate where you are now and what you stand for, you know.
Well, the only ways I've changed is that from my Mormon past, I kind of had the tacit assumption that whatever your philosophy was, you had to go around making converts all the time. I would avoid calling myself an anarchist these days, simply because Hagbard Chilean, the hero of the Illuminati trilogy, I found particularly admirable, and my head is, if I had it all to do over again, I would have done it his way, because he managed to weaken the government and made a living smuggling, and he didn't sacrifice himself at all, and he...
So is he like your role model or something, you think?
Yeah, I was talking about the role model, you know. If I had it to do over again, I never quite... But it's like, basically, you don't push too much the fact that you're an anarchist, and you don't throw yourself in the barricade like the anarchist. You don't throw yourself in the barricade like the anarchist.
Have you accomplished anything?
I've accomplished basically everything I wanted to accomplish.
You wanted to become a writer?
Yeah.
Have you lived the life of a writer?
Pretty much so, but not with much success on the economic end of it.
So you couldn't say you've made a living as a writer?
A couple of times I made a living as a writer of pornography for about a year at a time. I made a living as a writer, but Like I've got $100 here and $100 there.
And so what's the connection now between that and flour and the OPO?
Well, I'd like to do more flour when we die or do it better with chicken flea. So it's called F-O-W-A-L as well as F-O-U-L.
Okay. So are you suggesting that you were infected with these chicken fleas and that this might have something to do with...
Well, yeah, it seems kind of hard to believe it. I know one thing about these so-called paranoids is that paranoids and professional intelligence agents both. We're always very skeptical of certain things.
Well, homicide is not stupid. Yeah, so there are no question agents.
Well, basically, that's how it functions, or how we operate, and it's quite funny to me, you know, it's like, and due to humor, a lot of the department's trying to give it. Like I said, I'm not accusing them, but I'm not, you know, they do one thing. But, like I said, I doubt there are millions of things in the world.
Okay, it's clear coming up to the record. I'm getting a story about you talking to the Carolette South.
Yeah,
and in that we had a discussion that I related where you called me up on a Christmas day and you said, if you want to see me again, you better be here by night. And I said, are you dying? And you said, what do you think? And
well,
I can't take that the wrong way. Would you like to clarify that?
Well, I was living here in Terry's house right after I got out of the hospital. I was in for about a week. You know, so. And you were looking for a place to stay, and I got to thinking that the room would be ideal. I didn't realize it was such a mess. And we got to work, and working 50 hours a week, and I was gone. And she didn't like that that much, you know. So you could stay and live in my room with a 20 cat. For a week if you wanted, you had to give me your own, and I thought it was second lodging, second logistics for lodging. When I said, next week it'd be too late, because next week I'd be back in the room that you could use otherwise. So, put it out, and nothing like that anyway, and then after we spent the night in my room, smoking dope.
No, we spent like 3, 4, 5 last year.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the last things in the world that was on my mind at the time of death. Also, I don't really see death. I think we're terminalizing probably died in 1991 when I was very bad to get me together. I reconciled myself very easily there. I had a worry for NRC, you can continue to study, you can publish. In the introduction, we had a word with my other book, Confessions of Spiritual World, and dreadlocked recollections and that sort of thing. And so by naming the book in public like that, and another book is there, people knew it was there, and many new people had copies of that manuscript. For years, I took the others why it was popular. And put it in the very bodies already together to walk in one reason to keep it from being popular.
So, just to bring this back into the record here, we spent Christmas and up to New Year's together there, and you were struggling with your health at the time.
Well, I've been struggling with my health for many years.
And your cat. That sort of thing.
Yeah, well,
at that point, I wrote a story. You got mad at me.
Yeah, you said that for example, that I wanted to leave the door open to the cat to get it out. There's a Navajo blanket hanging over the doorway, and I wanted to leave the door about 4 inches open to the cat to come in and go out.
Okay.
And
because the beginning of the door open and nights that follow, the classification of two things are in my room. Mm-hmm. And you complain about the smell of cat fish. Well, you know, if it was about me jumping up and down that one night, well, I was jumping up and down like a cat thing. And so when I started taking the tranquilizer and sleeping, and kept opposing systems and getting
other ways. Okay, so you got mad at me, you talked about this, and you were like, well, you know, you make it look like I'm a crud or I'm dying or what.
You guys were talking about how messy the room was at some point.
I did mention that the cat had parasites or whatever, fleas or whatever.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was good at the time. I think my vet told me I had a flea allergy.
So now, the beginning of 1998, so now it's August.
Yeah.
So, bring us up to date on your health and your stuff.
Well, it's just like, at some point, you should get a new book to write a rebuttal because most of what you had said turned out to be true or things to be. And,
about the fleas? What about the fleas? Tell me about this.
Well, you know, they're well-known vermin. I was basically pushing them bumps off. Harmony, who's one of the two-packs, who's been really infected with this type of fleas.
And now?
And now what?
What is your condition?
Well, I thought I'm going to die in a few months because I've got all kinds of parasites. I've got the foot-type fleas, which are all fleas in the world known to burrow in the human skin. And where they go after that, anybody's guess, I guess. I don't think they stick to the skin. I don't think they roam around your body. And I've seen them burrow through Tupperware, so I imagine they could burrow through bone cartilage and stuff like that. It's really similar.
And what did your doctor say?
About what?
About the parasites.
Oh, he said he thought I was seeing things. So that gave me any kind of physical examination. And in fact, wanted me to see if I was hydrated. I said I wanted to see an epidemiologist. He said, then I'll maybe I'll let you see an epidemiologist. And I said, no, I said, I'd be glad to see a psychiatrist, but I want to see an epidemiologist.
Oh, then you did see an epidemiologist?
Yeah, but that was after I went to the dialysis that morning, and this woman came up, and so she was just making it around, and she was just saying, so I really felt better thoughts, you know, because I've gotten into very prominent nursing, you know, until I started business things there. And so I was trying to confront for him to work for him at first. I worked with him. Then, as we were saying, that I got up that morning and I had not been to dialysis. The previous surgery amount was Tuesday, and I really didn't feel good. I was having BD cells and all kinds of complaints. And so I called 911, and I knew I wouldn't be able to make it on the bus. And I called an ambulance, and the ambulance driver was male and female. And the driver was a male, and he said, he was quite a little picky, and he was kind of arguing about whether this was really constituting an emergency, and this, that, and the other thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was completely a sad argument, you
know.
And so I was, the driver was especially yelling back to him, and I swore him a couple of times that something was hit my dad. He got all flustered about that because it seems like I should use words like that around the lady. And I said, well, I was in the Marine Corps, and I was going to have bad habits. And he said, well, my father was in the Marine Corps, and we never used to say, no, I didn't do any of
them. He said, an ambulance, 911 call?
Yeah.
They didn't want to take you in, is that what
it was? Yeah, they were waiting for the constitution, getting an emergency.
Okay.
And finally, I convinced him that he did.
Uh-huh.
We drove off, and got down to the emergency room with Robert Long. His brother had taken me away from the dialysis clinic. And John had Robert Long in the emergency room and got the body function.
Got the body to a regular physician?
Yeah, and he's really orthodox physician. You know, he was not like a herbalism. He was anything of that nature. And he says, things are going to drive me crazy, unless we do something about him. And he says, well, I'm afraid that might already be the case. He might already be crazy.
Ah.
And I was planning to argue my case. Basically, I had no access to other doctors in the hands for him. You know what I'm saying? My whole hope of getting any medical attention to this paradise rests in the work of him that really existed. And he was not really interested in looking at any evidence.
Right.
And so it was very difficult. So I
he's a nephrologist, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he
but he's your primary surgeon, you think that's your primary diagnosis, right?
I'm dying of grandfathers, like the only people they needed to do IOS after him. And everybody here in it, I was getting all kinds of inappropriate characters. And the last thing at the Bayer operated more than an EKG, you know. And so I didn't want to be on the ground.
Well, I asked you earlier, and you raised your hand for the first time, but you didn't answer this time. Tell me about the epidemiologist and what the epidemiologist said.
Well, he was basically like all the other issues. He authored studies. crap get around running some fleas, and there's a whole cycle there. So I got maybe all around me on the path.
Okay, so I think you pretty much covered all that. So this is my favorite question when I get interviewed. Is there anything else you want to comment on?
I'm being sufficiently humbled by reality. I'm not that much advice, and I'm more like a little bit of 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 a little
bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of